people dismissed medieval faith as being valueless. It's almost like God left the church at Constantine and didn't come back until Martin Luther or maybe Wesley or maybe their own pastor.
I'm William O'Flaherty. You're listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. All About Jack is also part of the Theology Mix podcast network. Let's start things off with a question. When was the last time you thought about studying the Middle Ages? If you're like the average Christian, then you've probably never thought of that. But after listening to my guest today, you might change your mind. I'm speaking with Dr. Chris Armstrong from Wheaton College, and earlier in 2016, his book, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Christians, was published. Welcome to All About Jack, Chris.
Thanks so much, William. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, now, I purposely didn't give the subtitle of your book, so let's have you share that and then give some details into why you dragged C.S. Lewis into the Middle Ages.
Ah, okay. Did I drag C.S. Lewis or did he drag me? That's a question. The subtitle of the book, again, the title is Medieval Wisdom for Modern Christians. The subtitle is lengthy enough to be like something out of the 17th century, but it seemed like all the words needed to be in there. Finding Authentic Faith in a Forgotten Age with C.S. Lewis. And so there we are. At one point, the publisher wanted to take Lewis's name out of the title. And I said, well, he's in every chapter and in some places almost on every page. So I'd like to keep his name on the book. Yeah, it was really Lewis, as you said in an email to me earlier, that kind of dragged me into the Middle Ages, from being read aloud to at the table as a kid by my dad, who is a theologian and a big fan of Inklings and related authors. And getting that neo-medieval something out of those tales and that sense that there's an importance about the Middle Ages and there's some real values that we can learn from there, from chivalry and certain kinds of faith and, you know, on down the line. And so that opened my mind and my heart to that. I didn't become a Christian until later in my life, in my 20s. But at that point, I thought, well, I'm not hearing a whole lot from my Protestant friends about this 1,000 years of the church between about 500 AD and 1500. That's how I define the Middle Ages. A lot of scholars do that. Let me look into that a little bit. And despite the fact that my graduate studies were focused on American Christianity, especially evangelical versions in the 19th and early 20th centuries, I really developed this secondary prong of scholarly and personal interest as a Christian in what medieval faith and medieval modes of thinking and acting have to tell us. And lo and behold, C.S. Lewis was not only a professional medievalist in the sense of being a literary scholar, but as I came to discover and would argue now, is what I call an intuitive medievalist. It really deeply impacted in many ways, the ways that he thought and lived. You'll remember his address to Cambridge University on being installed as the chair of medieval and Renaissance studies when he says, I'm a dinosaur. I'm almost really from these earlier eras. And so you moderns may want to listen in on me and see what you can find out about those earlier times. And that's all I really did with this book, is I listened in for some ways in which we can benefit, especially as those of us who profess a Christian faith can benefit from some of the ways that Lewis lived and thought and processed on medieval ways of looking at faith.
Well, now, you start your book off by noting Christians and especially evangelicals, and I believe you put yourself in that camp, correct?
I do.
That they're the view of the Middle Ages as anything but a potential source for spiritual growth. What are a few false notions about that period of church history people have that prevent them from doing this?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, there's a lot of different ways in which we get the medieval period wrong. And, you know, some of them would be the idea that medievals were stupid, that, for example, they believed in a flat earth, which is actually purely nonsense and comes from some authors in the 19th century. The idea that medieval faith was all about working your way to heaven. Certainly, and people who know a little bit about the Reformation know that questions of salvation by grace or salvation by works were important questions at the time. But what they may not know is that Martin Luther was really addressing a small fraction of the theologians of his day who were beginning to get themselves in trouble with some ideas that you could become a Christian kind of by working your way to the kingdom. And but by and large, the theologian who is the dominant theologian throughout the entire period, everyone else is talking about his ideas and kind of footnoting what he said, was Augustine of Hippo, from really the cusp of the period right around the late 400s, early 500s, this period. Well, he's the early 400s, but his teachings become the fabric of medieval theology. And he is very clear on grace. In fact, he's a little bit extreme on grace. Some people would say that it is only through grace that and through irresistible grace of God that we can ever become Christians and become people who are redeemed. So, I mean, in a lot of ways, what we're dealing with is not a clear or historical picture of the Middle Ages, especially from a faith perspective, but rather a set of caricatures that are sort of dimly sifted through some Reformation ideas and some modern biases.
You could have played it safe and just focused on what one can learn from the medieval period, but you sort of step on toes by assessing evangelical Protestant churches today. Why did you take that risk, and how would you summarize your concerns?
First of all, I have to say, I owe my faith and a great deal that is good in my life to evangelical Protestant churches, churches that might profess a language like Bible-believing or born-again. And I don't know anymore what an evangelical really is, because I'm told that most of us vote for Trump, and I don't, and I don't really understand that. But in any case, I've learned so much and benefited so much from these churches. And really, as you say, I still consider myself in their fold. I worship in an Anglican setting in one of the many and pretty fast-growing Anglican evangelical churches in the country. So why do I take on some tendencies in this faith tradition? I think the most basic reason is that as I attempt now to live in the world as a Christian, to comport myself in my everyday life as a Christian, to understand the breadth of human culture and society as a Christian, culture, the arts, sciences, politics, all the many, many dimensions of who we are, family, intellectual pursuits, all the different scholarly disciplines. I've worked in universities for a long time. And what I find is, this is a critique that people as different as Mark Knoll and James Davison Hunter have also put forward, that evangelicals are not often deeply engaged in understanding these various facets of human life on earth. They tend toward a spiritualizing or even sometimes super spiritual approach that says what it really is to be a Christian is to save your soul and to say prayers and to go to church and to read your Bible and to evangelize. And all of those things are the crux of what life on earth is here about. And other than that, we're just kind of waiting to get to heaven. And we may have different views of the earth. We may be neutral to culture, or we may feel that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, and our job is to just save ourselves by the skin of our teeth and maybe a few other people as we move along. But I was looking for a more engaged and human and even material faith, something that tells us how to live as human beings where we find ourselves. And I asked myself, well, where am I going to get that information? And I thought, well, what about these 1,000 years? Again, 500 to 1500 AD. And wasn't this a time where the church was really engaged in every aspect of human life and culture? It's been called Christendom. We understand that there were sacred understandings and rituals surrounding every part of life. And I thought, let's go digging in there for a little while and see what we can find. And it was gravy for me that C.S. Lewis had done the same before and was, I feel, a very reliable guide on many aspects of medieval faith.
Your book consists of 10 chapters, but the focus of gaining authentic faith from the Middle Ages is in 8 of those chapters. So I'm wondering if maybe you can take the listener through a whirlwind tour of your key points in each of those chapters.
I'd be delighted to do that. I'll try to be brief. That's difficult for me because I'm an academic. I start off by talking about, my perspectives and where I come from as an evangelical and why I think it's salutary for us to understand some medieval faith themes. I go to then in the second chapter to talk about C.S. Lewis and his what I call medieval intuitive medievalism. And then I get into the themes in the following eight chapters, as you say. And the first of those thematic chapters is on tradition. And I'll tell you now the cute little phrases I used for each one. So the first one is on tradition. It's called Getting Rooted. That's the subtitle. Then theology, getting thoughtful. Then ethics, getting moral. Then compassionate ministry, and in particular, the growth in the medieval period of the hospital, which was a Christian institution, called Getting Merciful. And then creation and Christian attitudes towards creation in the material world, called Getting Earthy. And then the religion of the heart and our affective responses to God and in our worship is Getting Passionate. And then the incarnation, Getting Human. And then at the end, really kind of a summary and a little bit delving a little bit further into the themes of asceticism and monasticism. I call that Getting It Together. So that's a pretty fast whirlwind tour. I'd be happy to address any or all of those in a little bit more detail if you'd like. In particular, I think the tradition chapter at the beginning is crucial because it really makes the argument in words that Lewis himself used as well as in my own words for why, as Christians, it is crucial for us to go back and benefit from the teachers of our heritage and of our past. As Lewis said, you know, it's a good balance to maybe read two old books for every new book.
Chris, go ahead and give us a two or three sentence summary, if you could, of each of those chapters.
Sure, be happy to. In the tradition chapter, I really argue that we need to recover the medieval reliance on Christian tradition if we're to be Christian effectively in the modern world. Without tradition, we would have, just for starters, no consistent understanding of things, fairly important things like the Trinity, or indeed, we would not have a coherent canon of Scripture, because that develops through a traditioning process of people discerning the spiritual inspiration of different books and really beginning to develop that into a canon. That took place over tens and hundreds of years. And indeed, I would summarize that by saying that tradition anchors us against modern nonsense and bias. And that's an almost direct quote from C.S. Lewis. Then the next chapter, Getting Thoughtful, is about a medieval passion for theology. We need to value reason as God's highest earthly gift to humanity and good philosophy as a light to illuminate our paths in God, as the medievals did. And I really think we need to use that gift of reason again in the passionate search for theological understanding, again, as the medievals did. Lewis was very convinced of this. He defended the scholastics. He felt that Aquinas was but I think he said a sixth form boy in the same school as Lewis himself was, only Lewis was only a first form boy. Lewis was always, as you know, a philosopher at heart, even as he wrote his stories, a moral philosopher. And really, that's what our next chapter deals with. It's called Getting Moral, and it's about kind of the ethical fabric of medieval faith. And I argue here we need to examine our moral lives more precisely and with help from medieval traditions like that of what is typically called the seven deadly sins. The more accurate term is the seven capital vices, or the seven cardinal virtues is the other part of that tradition. We need to return to a sense that there is objective moral value, as Lewis argued, for example, in the abolition of man, the natural law argument. And I think we need to train up, as Lewis argued also in that essay, the abolition of man, need to train up our moral emotions, our moral affections, through the telling and hearing of stories, which of course Lewis did so well. Following that chapter, I wanted to say, all right, let's look at an area where a particular virtue takes on flesh and blood and becomes active in the world, and that's the virtue of mercy. And that is really a moral matter. And what I look at there is some theological lessons surrounding the medieval birth and growth of this new institution that had never been seen on earth, the hospital. And in doing that, reflecting on those theological lessons from looking at this very material, very active exercise of the virtue of mercy, we also need to affirm bodily health as a positive good. And that's really what the medievals did. That may surprise some people who may think of medievals as so heavenly minded that they're no earthly good, or as all sort of infected with this monastic ascetic approach that involves self-flagellation or thinking that the body is evil. That's certainly not the case in the largest monastic tradition, which is the Benedictine tradition. Benedict said repeatedly that we need to be moderate and that we need to value the body. And when a monk is sick, for example, you need to give them more to eat. You need to allow them to not do their chores for a while. So a clear valuing there of bodily health is a positive good. And I am just personally fascinated by the story of the hospital and was delighted to find a little talk by Lewis called, I think, something like Some Reflections, not a very descriptive title, which he was asked to give to a group of nuns in Ireland who were running a hospital. And he sat appropriately in the earthy setting of an inn, a tavern in Ireland, and he wrote out these thoughts about how Christianity has two sides. It has this spiritual side, and it also has a very earthy side. He said, I think this is almost a direct quote, Christianity is the only religion that leaves you free both to enjoy your breakfast and to something like mortify your flesh in the interest of spiritual improvement. So that's the chapter on hospitals. And it's a delightful little essay by Lewis. I'm able to give a few quotes from that essay during that chapter. The next one is called Getting Earthy, which is about creation. And I argue here that we modern Christians tend to have one or both of two kind of negative approaches or bad approaches to the created world, the material world. One is caricatured as Gnosticism, or at least people use that term. That's not quite an accurate term. Gnosticism was a very particular kind of Christian heresy in the early centuries after Christ. But I call it also super spiritualism, and I've already described it a little bit in the interview. It's just those things that don't say that the world is evil. I don't know very many Americans who would say the material world is evil, but that they really don't know what the spiritual significance of their material life is. So Sunday, they get that's a spiritual thing, but Monday through Saturday, I'm not really sure how that matters spiritually. And then the other view that we often take is a view of materialism. Nobody, again, is seriously saying, well, he who dies with the most toys wins. That would be an extreme version of materialism. But plenty of Christians are subtly sucked into the materialism of our larger culture, of a too high valuation of the comforts, for example, of a middle-class life, or getting the best education for our kids so they can get the best salary and so forth. And I want to probe both of those, the kind of super spiritual or Gnostic and the materialist view, and offer a medieval view as being really much more balanced and more healthy and more biblical in the end. And that is seeing the world as sacramental, which is full of God's presence. And so we don't value it to more than we should as a source of ultimate value, because it's valuable because it reflects God and his personality and glory, but also not valuing it too lowly as something evil, because indeed God created the world, and not only created the world, but came and inhabited the world in the incarnation. So that's the chapter on getting earthy. Just three more. One called Getting Passionate, as I mentioned. In this, I argue that we need to recover the Christian mystical tradition's seriousness about the bodily senses and the emotions. So we don't fool ourselves into thinking that Christianity is just something that happens up in our heads as we accept certain ideas, although it certainly does involve that, as I argue in the theology chapter. But also we need to cultivate compassion for others, and a great way to do that is by dwelling on the passion of Christ for us. And medieval certainly did that, especially in the last few centuries of the medieval period. The next chapter is on the incarnation. I call it Getting Human, and I start by thinking a bit about Mary and why Mary was so important for many medieval Christians. I don't go all the way with some of those ways in which Mary was elevated, but really what I find at the heart of all that is a deep commitment and a deep understanding of the incarnation, of the coming of God in the flesh. Evangelical Christians can sometimes tend to dismiss that amazing, miraculous event of God coming down in the flesh and kind of say, well, yeah, it happened, but the really important thing was that, you know, Christ lived 33 years, yada, yada, and then goes to the cross and dies on the cross for our sins. And that's the really important thing. And we don't stop, I think, sometimes to really meditate on what it means that God became part of the creation that he made. And not only part of the creation, but he became the part that is us. He became a human being. So I argue in this chapter, we need to see how the incarnation exalts not only the humanity of Christ, which is very important, a very important theme, but also the humanity of us. It has really raised us to another level of dignity that God would come and become one of us. The final chapter, as I mentioned, is called Getting It Together. And it's basically a summary and a quick review of some of the themes of the book, with a little bit more added on the ascetic and monastic traditions. I would just say my conclusion through this book, and I came to it slowly, it took me 6 years to write it, was that we really do need to drink from medieval and early Christian wells if we're to live our faith in truly human and truly world-engaging ways, not just this kind of super spiritual surface engagement with the world. And we need to consider also how the ascetic tradition of our faith and the monastic tradition can, maybe not by going and joining a monastery, but by some examples and by some principles, help us to live well in God and in the world. And although I haven't been explicit about it in describing every chapter, Lewis is there at every step of the way and has some wise and helpful things to say on every one of those things that I mentioned.
And I trust the listener will have their appetites whetted enough to want to explore your book more by getting a copy, or there's the first chapter that you can get a preview on your computer and such. I was mentioning to Chris before we started to recording that I really hadn't had a chance to look at his book until we started to nail down recording, and I understood what the title, the subject and whatnot, but I was really impressed with the material, and I look forward to digging deeper into it myself. Well, now, before we get into more about your book, let's pause and have you share some about who Chris Armstrong is. What is your day job? And tell us more about how Lewis has influenced your life.
Well, first of all, I guess who I am. I'm a 50-something professor of church history who is not currently teaching in the classroom. I work at Wheaton as the founding director of something called OPUS, the Art of Work, which is an institute on faith and vocation. And so I don't actually, I'm occasionally in classrooms talking with students, more often actually talking with professors, but exploring the roots and theological contours of the Christian idea of vocation, how that influences the ways that we think about work. I actually see that as deeply connected to this book that I've written. Which again came out of an impulse to want to understand how we live those ordinary parts of our lives differently, or how we may or should live those differently in light of Christ and what he's done for us and our own Christian faith, those of us who claim that faith. And so that's what I do during the days. It's a delightful job. Wheaton College is a great place to work, wonderful colleagues, and it's just been a real pleasure over the past couple of years. I keep a hand in to church history by helping with a magazine called Christian History. They're available at christianhistorymagazine.org, and it's available on a donation basis. I have to say that I've been involved with the magazine since 2002, and I just think it's a wonderful thing. It's something that is intended to bless and inform educated Christians who have an interest in things historical and interest in the larger questions of the church and the church's traditions. So I do keep a hand in. I don't do a whole lot. I have the title of senior editor, which means other people do most of the work, and I get to be part of the fun meetings where we decide what issue we're going to do next, et cetera. The next issue that's coming up is on, in fact, creation and creation care, and was a delight to work on. So I would encourage folks who have that particular interest to take a look for that. I have 5 kids. I live in Wheaton, Illinois, and you asked me about C.S. Lewis and what he's meant to me. As a child, not a Christian, but growing up in a nominally Christian household, I heard the Narnia stories, probably heard Screwtape Letters and The Great Divorce, and encountered the Space Trilogy when I was a teenager and absolutely loved that. I was not really taken by the apologetic works, which tended to be wielded as almost cudgels by folks in the local, folks in the local college student ministry who felt they could argue me into the kingdom. So it was kind of put off. I really didn't return to Lewis's essays and his theological writing until much later in life. When I did, which was really just over about the last 10 years, I discovered riches that, I learn and I grow in my faith and in my understanding as a human being every time I read Lewis. It's not all perfect. There's some points on which I would argue, and I still have a hard time getting through Mere Christianity because I sense sometimes a little bit of a bullying tone there. People can argue with me. That's fine. But an absolute, what I find the most valuable about Lewis is that he is a conduit of tradition. In fact, a lot of the things that I think people think, oh my goodness, that's such an original idea about Christianity. He would be appalled to think that he was having original ideas. He was channeling to us the riches of our own spiritual heritage.
Returning to your book, let me have you pick one of the chapters dealing specifically with the medieval themes, the 8 chapters that you were summarizing just a few moments ago. Pick any one of those chapters to give us some more aspects of it.
Sure, I'd be happy to. The section I'm going to pick is actually from the beginning of the last chapter called Getting It Together, but it's also kind of a summary of some themes from the chapter before it, Getting Human, which is on the incarnation. And I argue here that the incarnation and an understanding of, again, God coming in the flesh as a human being as Jesus Christ is central to all of the many themes that I've been dealing with in the previous chapters. So it underwrites medieval's high valuation of tradition, their passion for theology, their detailed and intentional morality, their compassionate ministry to bodies as well as souls, their understanding of the sacramental quality of the created world, their investment of emotion into their devotion to the Lord, and their willingness to discipline their bodies in service of that same devotion. And so I ask the question in this final chapter, which is again to my fellow Christians, modern Western Christians, what would happen if we recaptured these medieval values? And the first thing I touch on is this matter of tradition. By putting the body, the material, the humanity back into our understanding of Christ and his church, I think we'd be seeing again how fitting it is for us to study and value our own traditions. We'd recapture the wisdom and truth in those traditions while never separating that truth from the primary revelation of Scripture. Because what is tradition? It's nothing less than the wisdom and truth passed down from generation to generation through history. So that's a very human process. It's not a list of timeless principles or abstract teachings. Christianity is a uniquely historical religion based on a historical person and the words of two testaments that are full of historical accounts. And so when we realign ourselves and understand the incarnation a little bit more fully as the medievals did, then that can lead us to value tradition very highly as the very human process through which the wisdom of our faith has come down to us. Now, is it perfect? Is it flawless? Absolutely not. And by the way, I never argue in the book that there are no flaws in medieval faith. There are traditions and beliefs and even practices that I would not affirm. But I think that basically I'm arguing from a perspective of someone who is a church history professor who taught for 10 years in the seminary, where immediately people dismissed medieval faith as being valueless, almost like God left the church at Constantine and didn't come back until Martin Luther or maybe Wesley or maybe their own pastor. And I just, that's unfortunate and perhaps stems a little bit from a sense that, well, Christianity is just a bunch of principles. It's just a bunch of things we can learn from a book called the Bible. It's not a human historical thing. So moving on, incarnation and theology and ethics. I think if we renewed attention to the incarnation, this could also renew our passion for theology. Focusing devotionally on the world-changing entry of God into his own creation in human form also directs our minds to how amazing God's interactions with the world and humanity are. And that, after all, is the central theme of theology, not God in the abstract or by himself, not humanity by themselves, but those interactions between God and humanity. And by the way, interactions that we can study and understand through a mode of faith-seeking understanding, using that precious image of God in us, that image of reason that comes into us because we are patterned after God, who is a reasonable God. So it would perhaps renew our passion for theology if we took the incarnation seriously. An easy one to see is a renewed incarnational awareness gives us, or can give us, a renewed and particular energy toward compassionate ministry. as it did for Christians in the medieval period who worked in and gave to and fostered the hospitals that grew up in that period. The medieval Christians' acute awareness of the incarnation wasn't some theologically fuzzy, inward-turned mysticism. As they began to enter emotionally into the events of the Passion, the compassion for Jesus that this stirred in them overflows and enables them to perceive Jesus in other humans, just as Matthew 25 says, that the things that we do for those, the least of those around us, cups of cold water and clothing the naked and healing the sick, are all things that we're actually doing for Jesus. And it's easier to see that when we come back to the incarnation and the wonder of Jesus, the humanity of God as Jesus Christ. And attention to incarnation can renew our sense also of the wonder of creation for obvious reasons. The God who created the world has now entered and participated in it and thus gave creation a kind of renewed dignity. Another thing that the incarnation can do for us as a theme is to bring back to us the kind of affective devotion, the investment of the heart and the emotions into our devotion that was much more widespread in the early centuries of the church and in the early medieval period than it has become in the modern period. Again, when we see the suffering that Jesus underwent in the flesh, and that draws people to him in a deeply human way and an emotional way. A taste of that we had some years ago with Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ, which drew strongly on some medieval traditions about the Passion of Christ. And then finally, a heightened sense of Christ's humanity can lead us to pay more attention to our own humanity, which can help us realize the spiritual significance of our humanity and the things that we do in the flesh. And that really doesn't just mean the things that we do that are spiritual, like kneeling or reading or going to church. It can mean the things we do in our everyday work, the things we do in our family lives, and indeed it can lead us to a renewed, maybe even ascetic discipline, as we realize that there are some temptations in our fleshly life to overeat, to be distracted by money and fame and power and all of those things that appeal to the flesh, and to begin to engage in spiritual disciplines that will help us with those things. Again, if we're clear about our own humanity and the value and wonder of that humanity, that helps us recognize the need also to discipline aspects of that humanity. So those are some of the themes from the final chapter. And William, I just want to thank you for allowing me to share this. I've enjoyed talking with you. I hope folks will enjoy this and get a chance to check it out.
Where can people learn more about your book, as well as where can they get it online, or what bookstores are you thinking that they might find it at?
Sure. All of that is helpfully on one website. This was put together by the marketing folks over at Baker Books. The book is a Brazos book, which is one of the imprints of Baker Bookhouse out of Grand Rapids. And they created a website simply called medievalwisdom.com. There's a hyphen between the medieval and the wisdom. You can download a first chapter there. You can see some nice things people have said about the book, a bit of a summary of the book, and there's some links at the bottom to different bookstores where you can get it. And finally, there's a set of 5 brief video clips from an interview I did a while back as well on the subject of the book.
In closing, what appeal would you make to those still maybe on the fence about learning regarding this forgotten age to gain authenticity in their faith by reading your book?
Boy, that's a great question. I think I would say that if you're sensing some of the same struggles that I've sensed over time and some of the reasons that I went to study this period and write this book, if you're wondering how to more fully live out your Christian faith in the ordinary parts of your life, in your work, in your family, and related to culture, related to all of the wonders of this earth that we live on and the human culture that we live in the midst of, don't dismiss the medieval period. There are some deeply faith-informed and helpful understandings and practices that come from that period. Yes, as a youth pastor of mine used to say, you have to chew the chicken and spit out the bone, and there's some bones along the way, but there's also a lot there that's nourishing, and there are books, even other than my own, believe it or not, that do a good job of presenting some of these themes. One of the best ones is called Many Mansions by David N. Bell, who is a scholar and professor from Newfoundland, and there are many others. So I would encourage you to look into it. We've done, again, Christian History Magazine has done a few issues related to medieval themes. You can read those online for free. And so that's a way to get a toe in the water and a taste. But if you're encouraged to look more into what God was doing in his church and on earth during that mysterious thousand-year period that C.S. Lewis was so in love with, I'd encourage you to take a look at my book.
All right. And again, the title of Chris's book is Medieval Wisdom for Modern Christians. Chris, thanks for being on All About Jack.
Thanks so much, William. It's been a real pleasure.
Let me also thank you, the listener, for taking the time to hear the conversation I had with Dr. Chris Armstrong. Again, the book he wrote is Medieval Wisdom for Modern Christians, Finding Authentic Faith in a Forgotten Age with C.S. Lewis. You can follow the links in the show notes to either buy the book, get a sample chapter, or visit the website he mentioned. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, the host and creator of this podcast, All About Jack, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. All About Jack is also part of the Theology Mix podcast network. I hope you enjoy the show and will consider sharing it with others. The show notes I mentioned a moment ago can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast is most easily found and navigated. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. The other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, highlights the most recent show on the main page and also has space dedicated to listing past shows and the notes for them. Additionally, you can find a variety of other material on Lewis there, including a popular series that explores quotations attributed to him that may not be from him. At the time this podcast is first posted, not long ago I began posting various videos from the Inklings Week in Oxford from summer 2016. I also did an audio podcast of the one-on-one interview I did with Walter Hooper at his home while I was at that conference retreat. In addition to those new shows, I occasionally post previously released podcasts on my iTunes feed that you can find at the Podbean address as well. If you don't know how to find the show on iTunes, then be sure to check the show notes for a direct link. Again, those notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllaboutJack.podbean.com. If you do visit the iTunes location, please consider rating my podcast as this can help others find it there. Finally, let me remind you, in case you didn't know, I have a book called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. It's available online at Amazon. Paperback is $14.99, and presently the Kindle version is just $5.49. You can learn more about my book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com.